Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we examine the economic challenges and opportunities facing the paper industry, nationally, globally, and in our own backyard here in Wisconsin. The paper industry was born out of our ancient North Woods, the pinery that provided the logs that built 19th century America, and the pulp that made our mills the envy of the world. But the industry here in Wisconsin is facing challenges like never before, from a digital age in which paper is becoming an afterthought, and from cheap, efficient, technologically sophisticated competition overseas. In Wisconsin, our mills have been closing at an average of one a year since 2006, in Park Falls, in Neenah, in Port Edwards, in Kimberly, and most recently in Brokaw. We've got two great guests with us today to discuss this topic. Here in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios, we have Jerry Lazarski, the executive director of the UW-Stevens Point Paper Foundation. He spent most of his life working for the paper industry in the Wisconsin River Valley as a production manager and mill manager of Consolidated Paper's Wisconsin Rapids Mill, and then later as vice president of technology and business development for Stora Enso North America. Joining us by phone, John Schmidt, an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, whose recent series, Paper Cuts, detailed the threats Wisconsin's homegrown industry faces, not just from a digital age, but from Chinese competition. We've got a link to that series on the Route 51 Facebook page. And as always, we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 if you've got questions for our guests or if you've got comments about the state of the paper industry in Wisconsin. That's 1-800-780-9742. John and Jerry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here, Glenn.
Jerry, let's start with you. You've had a long career in the paper industry in the Wisconsin River Valley, and now you're the executive director of the UW-Stevens Point Paper Foundation, which a lot of people haven't heard of. What is it, and what are you trying to accomplish?
The Paper Science Foundation at UW-Stevens Point has been around for nearly 40 years, and our primary purpose is to support our engineering students financially with scholarships and grants, also to support the faculty and to interact with faculty with regard to academics. We are strongly supported by the paper industry here in Wisconsin and by many of the allied industries.
And you've got a Bachelor of Science, Paper Science and Engineering degree from UW-Stevens Point back in 1974. How important is the paper science program at that school? I mean, it's certainly got a long history.
Right. We're a real bedrock with regard to our engineering program on campus. We're one of the only Central Wisconsin University that is an ABET accredited engineering program. And with the shortage of engineers nationwide, we're certainly filling a need that industry has, particularly in Wisconsin, but in the rest of the nation as well.
Now, you were the production manager and later the mill manager at Consolidated Paper, and then you were there for the sale to Stora Enso, later becoming the vice president of technology and business development. Give us an idea of what things were like when you started at the mill.
Back in the early 70s, I started out as a process engineer, a summer engineer, actually, at one of the Consolidated Mills. And we were rolling along pretty good back in the 70s and 80s. And just kind of looking out one corner of the eye what the international impact might be, what we were seeing, particularly at that time from Europe, more so than from China.
And what kinds of things changed over the years, and how were things different when Stora Enso ended up acquiring the facility?
When Stora Enso came on the scene, it was turned into a much more international competitive arena for us. We had a lot of nationwide competition within the U.S., and there were many, many more paper companies competing at that point in time. But by the time Stora Enso got into acquiring Consolidated Papers, things had already begun to condense quite a bit with regard to the number of paper companies being absorbed, merging with other paper companies, and fewer numbers of paper companies nationwide.
Consolidated was run for many years by George Meade and the Meade family. And these people, you know, they were like father figures to the communities. They were philanthropists. They lived in town. They cared about the people in the town. Did the culture change?
There was no question about that. The Meade family, Meade-Witter families, were a cornerstone in basically most of central Wisconsin, Portage County, Wood County, not just the city of Wisconsin Rapids. And what we used to say, our blood used to run blue, consolidated blue. That was the consolidated colors. And that's the way most employees felt as well. Mm-hmm. We had that feeling of family ownership and family connectivity.
Has that been lost in today's paper industry?
That has gone by the wayside. I saw that happening during the last years of my career. It became more business oriented and less seeing the real owners walk the floors, walk the machine aisles, mm-hmm. Talk with the employees. It was not uncommon to see members of the Meade family and the board of directors make regular appearances in the mill, even at different hours of the evening, checking up on things, taking their guests through the mills, and showing up, you know, points of pride. And so that connectivity, that closeness,
right.
certainly waned.
And you were the production manager at the mill, then the mill manager. You worked side by side with these guys. You've made paper. Is there anything that you didn't do in the paper mill?
Yeah, there were a lot of things I didn't do. We had a good team, and that was one of the things that changed. The teamwork became more, shall we call it, organized teamwork, business teamwork, as opposed to camaraderie teamwork, where you helped your fellow engineers early in my career. You helped your fellow supervisors within the same mill at the same levels, and that's changed somewhat.
And then Stora Enso came in, and you helped them with the transition. Right?
Right. I was in the Wisconsin Rapids Mill at the time of the transition, and those were interesting times. There were scary times. We were used to having known our owners on a personal basis, knowing members of the Meade family and knowing members of the board of directors in the mills, and that to knowing or learning to know people that were in Helsinki, Finland.
Right.
And that was quite a...
Stora Enso, a Finnish company.
Right. Swedish-Finnish, either Stockholm or Helsinki. You had the groups coming from both areas. And so there was a real culture change for us. Stora Enso did a nice job in recognizing the cultural differences and trying to accommodate that.
And you were in charge of instituting technical innovation and cost reduction strategies, right, for mills all across the country?
For the Wisconsin Rapids Mill.
For the Wisconsin Rapids Mill,
right,
particularly.
Right.
Okay.
Each business unit was assigned tasks with regard to, okay, we've got to get into cost reduction here. This is a global market now. We're not just competing against U.S. companies. We're competing against international companies.
And do you feel that today the paper industry in North America can compete globally and specifically can compete against the Chinese?
That's an awesome task. When you look at the equipment, and by the way, John did an excellent job in his piece with regard to showing what China has in terms of their investments and what the Chinese government has invested in, without a doubt, the biggest, widest, fastest machines in the world. They've gone out and they've built them. And they built the infrastructure with 12, 14, 16-lane highways connecting some of the mills to support that. So that's a big distinction. Our companies are independent companies here in the U.S. for the most part. And even from a standpoint of getting some tax benefits to get over some of those hurdles, mm-hmm. Has certainly been a challenge.
John Schmidt, tell us about the series that you wrote, Paper Cuts. A lot of research went into it for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And incidentally, if you want to look at that, we do have a link to it on our Facebook page, the Route 51 Facebook page.
Thanks, Glenn. It's great to share the show with Jerry, because what he comes right out of the trade, he spent a career in it, and I know what he's doing up there. Stephen's point is quintessential to what remains in Wisconsin of the paper trade, and of the technical training and engineering programs. I think he's one of the last bastions who are doing that, which is a legacy of what Wisconsin once stood for. I didn't come out of the trade. I'm an economics reporter. I specialize in globalization and economic change. And what I saw in Wisconsin was a fascinating, ripe opportunity. If you take a step back and think about what are the big mega economic forces that are reshaping the global economy, pretty much everyone's short list would have digital change, digital networks, information that moves instantly with digital speed, hyperlinked, interactive, video, what have you. That's one. That's unambiguous. That's unequivocal. And the other is China-centric globalization. And both of these are sending body blows into this significant, huge part of the northern Wisconsin economy that I call the pulp, paper, and print economy. It's all over a century old. There are tens and thousands of jobs at stake. And if I may, I'll just outline, you know, how I see this part of the economy, the cellulose economy of Wisconsin.
Yeah, please do, John.
You're starting with a state that has a rich tradition in forestry. You could say, if you wanted to be a little bit crass, that there are more trees than Wisconsin knows what to do with these days. These are great trees. These are hardwood trees. They have great fiber. They've always been the premium slow-growth hardwood trees that are perfect for things like books, bestsellers, catalogs, hymnals, owner's manuals, amounts of magazines, for instance.
Even more than that, those trees helped build the America of the 19th century.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And so you've got this abundant natural resource. You've got the rivers. Very few people know this, but the very first hydroelectric dam in the world, not in Wisconsin, in the world, was it built on a paper mill in Appleton, Wisconsin. It made an electric grid lighting up a town faster and before Thomas Edison did the same thing in New York. That's the kind of early innovation. So you had rivers, you had trees. This gave rise to the paper mills. This goes back 150 years. Wisconsin to this day remains the biggest paper-making state. And you're talking about a production that is staggering to someone like myself who's not in the trade. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of tons of paper a year. It's astronomical. It was, you know, paper, after all, was what powered civilization and propelled civilization for the 600 years since Gutenberg. But there's another element to this that makes Wisconsin unique and gives Wisconsin this very, you know, unique prism on digital change in the world. You can't move paper rolls that each weigh several tons hundreds and hundreds of miles to another printing plant, especially in the sort of pre-interstate, pre-semi-trailer age. So printing plants, commercial printing plants, printing presses, as we all knew them, sprouted close to the mills. And so today, to this day, you still have a fairly large number of printing press operators in Wisconsin that make the books, that often make the magazines. For instance, just to give you a notion of what we're talking about, the largest single printing facility in the Western Hemisphere is in Lomira, Wisconsin. So,
what facility is that, John?
That are basically powered by ink on paper. And when you think that we live in the age of Google and the iPad, that seems precarious. That it's an astonishing industrial legacy, and that was one of our starting points for this project.
What's the name of the printing press in Elmira?
It's the town is called Lomira. It's
Lomira.
On the highway up, if you're going up to Appleton. It's run by an outfit called Quad Graphics, which is huge. They're the second biggest commercial printing company in North America. They keep expanding, which keeps jobs in Wisconsin, because what they do is buy other printing plants or printing companies. They just did a huge one in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then they shut down the inefficient mills, bring the contract work to Wisconsin, and that keeps Wisconsin going. However, all that's doing, in to some degree, is masking the pressure that's on the industry. You have other big printing operations like the Bonta Corporation, the fabled decades-old Bonta Corporation. They were something like the nation's biggest printer of textbooks. And R.R. Donnelly came in and bought them up and shut down their flagship facility. So, you know, they're going out just like the paper mills.
So the printers and the paper mills kind of grew together out of the same economic forces at the turn of the last century. Your series, the first part of the series, starts out in the Northwoods of Wisconsin. The second part of the series starts out in a Chinese laboratory tree farm.
Yeah. Well, you can't separate logging and forestry in Wisconsin from the paper industry in Wisconsin. And I hope we have some chance to talk about that later, because it's just a fascinating part of what we call the economic ecosystem. China, we're well into the 21st century. Industries in Wisconsin in particular are inured to the kind of competition that comes from China. It's sudden, it's rapid, it's low cost, it's winner take all. It's a very difficult competitive situation. But as the Wisconsin mills were struggling with sort of this digital intrusion into this nice pastoral Northwoods industry that they had, they never reckoned that China would come and Bigfoot them. And, you know, the reasons were, well, China makes iPads. It increasingly consumes and designs them as well. It makes the tablets. It makes the e-readers. It makes the Kindles. It's in that, what do they want with a commodity product like paper that doesn't seem very sexy? But the main reason that so few in Wisconsin reckoned that China was going to come out of nowhere, they're now, by the way, the world's biggest paper maker. They tripled production in the last 10 years. They grew at a staggering, staggering rate.
If I can, in your article, one of the statistics is that they produce more in 3 weeks than the state of Wisconsin produces in an entire year.
Yeah. But what's remarkable, and what I wanted to, the reason I wanted to tie in forestry, Glenn, is that China doesn't have trees. Wisconsin's got an abundance of them, and you could talk about rivers too. The rivers in China are the most polluted, of this 10 most polluted rivers in the world, 7 are in China. China does not have the natural resources for this that, Wisconsin does. How did they do it? Why did they do it? These were a lot of the questions that we wanted to explore in our project.
Well, we pioneered the whole concept of renewable forests, of harvesting and growing woodlands, basically taking what were natural resources, and then after we clear-cut them, the pioneers in the paper industry realized that we needed to start harvesting these forests as a crop, planting new trees, growing them on a sustainable basis, and you write that China has taken that concept one step further.
Yeah, they globalized it. We called it, what Wisconsin developed was fascinating. George Mead, you know, Jerry's former employer, Consolidated Paper, was probably one of the greatest pioneers and leaders in it. They looked out in Wisconsin circa 1920, and they saw a clear-cut state. They saw a dystopian future without the resources that were going to keep the mills going, assuming that there was going to be a son to hand it down to. This notion of renewable forestry very much is such a Wisconsin tradition. Just here's another fact for you, that if you look at the 50 United States, Wisconsin ties Minnesota in terms of its high share of certified renewable forest land in the state. It leads the nation in it to this day. China doesn't have trees, so they innovated like crazy. And, you know, this is something where I think that sometimes, or often I hear tell, that Americans tend to be a little bit too complacent. The Chinese are reverse engineers. The Chinese are copycat engineers. The Chinese don't know how to innovate. The Chinese don't know how to patent. Well, beware, because I think that this is one of these instances where you can see where the Chinese, when they put their head to it, really want to innovate. For instance, why do you want to get into paper in the first place if you're in China? The answer to that is that paper in China is a really important, very potent, very powerful national symbol. Paper was invented in China 1,000 years ago, a full millennium ago. This notion of reconstituting fibers, that's a Chinese idea. Every Chinese school child will learn that there are four great inventions, gunpowder, the compass, printing, and paper. China lays claim to these. These are, and as China wants to become an innovative, an innovation economy as well mm-hmm. as a high production manufacturing, high efficiency economy, it wants to use its national symbols to remind the rest of the world of these national aspirations.
Now. You talk about how China is bioengineering new strains of already fast-growing eucalyptus trees in what you describe as test tube forests. That was completely new to me as a layman when I read your article, and I'm sure that our listeners would find that fascinating.
Yeah, again, it's a great comparison. You walk with loggers in the Northwoods of Wisconsin, and it's one of the prettiest things you could do on God's green earth. These are beautiful forests. The trees in this wintry climate, often for the hardwoods, often take 40 to 50, sometimes more, years to grow. In China, you could do it 10 times faster. You get 10 times more pulp per acre.
You're talking about growing a 50-foot tree in 4 years?
I've seen them. We have a lot of pictures on the website of what these timberlands look like. This is the eucalyptus tree. It is a hardwood. It's very fiber rich. It's used a lot of the books that you have in your own library these days are coming from them nowadays. Brazil played around with them, but no one did it with the same kind of assembly line intensity as China. They clone them. They cross hybrid them. They hybridize them. They are creating what they call the super tree. Whenever they get a strain of tree that grows really tall, they immediately clone it over and over and over, and they keep doing that until they just get the best, fastest trees that you possibly can.
Jerry Lazarski, you encountered this with Store Enzo?
Right. Store Enzo, I think about 15 years ago, which I think preceded some of the Chinese work, explored the eucalyptus plantation concept on basically wasteland down in South America, areas that had been cut over and had been gone to waste due to non-certified logging practices by some other people. And they took over some of this land and put in hybrid eucalyptus trees as well on a very fast rotation, similar to raising corn. Basically, in the same amount of time, the eucalyptus tree by nature is a fast-growing. It's a weed, basically, but it makes a good sheet of paper.
Now, our woodlands not only supply trees for our mills, they provide habitat for birds and animals. They're a source of recreation. John Schmidt, what are the test tube tree farms in China like?
Oh, well, we were in Hainan, that's China's southernmost province, and we were driving around for hours, for about a half of a week, just looking at timberlands, a photographer from the Journal Sentinel and myself. In Wisconsin, you're gonna see pickup trucks, a couple taverns, and then mile after mile of timberlands, much like when you're driving across the rest of the Midwest, you see soy or corn. It's just like farmland, only trees. China, it's very small rural villages, two-stroke, loud, noisy motorcycles, usually carrying multiple people, livestock running wild. And you do see, and because this is a statistical fact, you do see the poverty that China is living with. Poverty, is part of this unusual Chinese economic dynamic, which I should just mention because it's part of why China wants to subsidize so many of its state industries. China is an anomaly in the world economy. It's got a world-class, high-tech, high-productivity economy driven by great engineering universities on the one hand that coexist with some of the world's most intense dirt-poor poverty third world style on the other. And this creates a lot of social tension. This is what keeps the Chinese political elite awake at night, because they don't want another Tiananmen Square. And so they do grow their industries and subsidize like crazy, actually, in order to keep investment coming in, keep industry growing, keep exports growing in China. And that's part of the story that we told.
How much money do they pump into their paper industry?
It's estimated at $33 billion over the past 8 years. The numbers are actually pretty staggering. And what's odd is that there's a debate right now, it's a fairly recent one, about how when the United States led the world debate on letting China 10 years ago into the World Trade Organization, the Geneva, Switzerland-based WTO, that's the referee organization, the sole group that tries to police how global trade rules work.
Right.
The expectation was that China was going to move more toward a market economy, more toward an entrepreneurial economy, more toward a bottoms-up economy.
You don't think that's happening?
What you've seen, though, recently, and you see it very clearly in the paper industry, is that Beijing has decided to go back to its autocratic levers for a top-down, state-heavy, state-autocratic model where Beijing is picking its winners and Beijing is showering them with subsidies.
How do we compete against something like that in Wisconsin?
Jerry, you want to take the first swing?
Well, John, earlier you mentioned the word innovation a couple of times, and what that brings to mind in the history of papermaking in Wisconsin to me is what happened when the newsprint went to Canada. Most of the mills in Wisconsin back in the day made newsprint. There weren't as many, there weren't many magazines, there weren't many high-quality products being produced, and so we all made newspapers. And then there was a major change in economic policy, both on the U.S. side and the Canadian side, and all the newsprint manufacturing basically went to Canada. And we were left with mills in Wisconsin that had paper machines that weren't all that old at that time, had nothing to make. And this is where Consolidated, as an example, invented the coated paper process. And Allah, Time Magazine, Look, Life, Newsweek, these magazines were basically born out of necessity because the newsprint industry was gone and we had to do something with our paper mills.
Are you saying that those glossy covers came from this new technology that was pioneered?
That's right. That didn't exist prior to the changeover of the newsprint industry. So here you have a situation where you have an outside force causing us to be innovative. And this is what Americans have always done best. We're innovators, okay? We can talk about test tube farming. That's been around. Take a trip down to Madison, U.S. Forest Products Lab. John, you've been there, I'm sure, and see what they're doing with nanotechnology and great things. Campus on Point, UW-Stevens Point, with our paper machine, some of the work the students are doing in the research area, particularly in the biofuels area now. We are still at the forefront of innovation, in my opinion. We have the universities, we have the minds, we have the culture that when the chips are down, we innovate. Okay,
gentlemen, we've got to take a quick break. In fact, we're way overdue for it. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Jerry Lazarski, who is the executive director of the Paper Foundation at UW-Stevens Point, and John Schmidt, an investigative journalist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, whose series Paper Cuts details the threats facing the Wisconsin paper industry in the digital age and from China. Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
And our forecast for north central Wisconsin tonight, clear and cold with a low of 20 degrees. Winds out of the north Friday, mostly sunny, a high of 46. Light snow developing Friday night, a low of 30. Saturday, snow changing to light rain, a high of 44, a low of 30. Sunday, partly cloudy with a high of 46 and a low of 30. We've got partly to mostly sunny skies across north central Wisconsin. 43 degrees right now in Woodruff, Eagle River, Land O'Lakes, Marshfield, and Stevens Point. 45 in Tomahawk and Antigo. 52 in Wapaka, 49 in Wisconsin Grandson Rapids, 48 in Phillips, 46 degrees in Medford, Merrill, and outside our studio in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network, talking about the economic challenges facing the paper industry and the effects those challenges are having on real people, with John Schmidt, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Jerry Lazarski, who is the head of the UW Stevens Point Paper Foundation and a former vice president with Stora Enso America. Gentlemen, I want to get into exactly how the upheaval in the paper industry is affecting real people. We've had a number of mill closures, the closure in Brokaw, the closure in Port Edwards, and now, most recently, Wausau Paper has announced that it is selling its mill in Mosinee and in Rhinelander. Here's a story that I produced on that very subject just a couple of weeks ago. The Mosinee paper mill dominates the landscape and the economy of this old mill town, straddling the Wisconsin River on the busy four-lane Highway 153 corridor. There's more at stake here than the mill's 450 good-paying jobs.
Well, my dad was the original Charlie, but I'm the second generation. Jeff and Pam are the third generation.
Chuck and Jeff Kehos mind the store at Charlie's Hardware, which has been in business since 1957, serving the people who work at the mill and the other businesses that depend on it. Chuck Kehos says he's hoping for the best.
It's a great feeling. It's another investment firm, and we're concerned about it. According to the papers that we've read and heard on TV, they do have a lot of experience in the paper industry, and that's a big positive.
The New York investment firm KPS Capital Partners has a history of buying and turning around troubled companies. Jeff and Chuck Kehos know it's not just their hardware store that depends on what an East Coast company decides to do with Mosinee's biggest employer.
Basically, the town is built around it, so a lot of those employees that work over there live in our town, and that's what makes us go around.
It's not only important to us here, it's important to help our community grow and stay together, from the roads to the schools to everything around. It's very important. Morale-wise, too.
KPS is planning to buy the Mosinee and Rhinelander mills for $130 million. In Mosinee, I'm Glenn Mobrick for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Now, John Schmidt is somebody who's seen a number of these takeovers, and as a student of global economy, how do you feel about this this sale of these two mills?
I think it's a pretty clear reflection that the... Oh, for lack of a better word, the investment community, Wall Street, has noticed that society is now mesmerized by touch screens, and that's where investment is going. The Wisconsin model of papermaking, now about 150 years old, has fallen out of favor. You have multiple examples in the state of Wisconsin in which call it global hot money, is, you know, pulling out of the business of making paper and then printing on it in so many ways. Jerry worked for a long time at Consolidated Paper, and you bought that. What's happened there since Stora Enso sold out its share also is fairly reflective. If you want a quick vignette on that, Jerry, or I could give it to you, but in short, they sold from family-owned George Mead for a century. It was basically inventing the modern age of paper in Wisconsin. It was North America's biggest maker of coated paper and invented coated paper. At peak in 2000, George Mead sold to Stora Enso. Stora Enso held it for a few years and sold it to the Siberius private equity firm. Their ownership...
they remarketed all those mills as New Page, right?
That is correct. And they bought six mills in Wisconsin and quickly closed three of them before New Page itself had to declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. So, I mean, you could see what happens with the intrusion of you know, the need for capital returns from these older businesses.
You know, so-called vulture capitalism became a big issue in the last presidential election, but realistically, can any of this be changed, John Schmidt, and should it be?
Can you turn an empty paper mill in the North Woods of Wisconsin into an iPad factory? Probably not. You know, you want to talk about innovation, and that should be a big part of this discussion or any discussion. Wisconsin absolutely took the lead in so many ways. Think of what the world was like before consolidated paper and George Meade's grandfather invented coated paper. You had pulpy magazines that, you know, grainy. Suddenly you had coated paper and you had snap and brilliance in your old black and white pictures. Suddenly ad rates went up. Oddly, just by the way, big irony, the biggest...
Well,
the biggest grade of paper that China loves to make and China loves to export is coated paper. China took over Wisconsin's strength in that regard.
Well, I want Jerry to weigh in on this, but before he does, I'm interested in what you think of this particular transaction with the company that is buying the Mosinee and Rhinelander mills. The people at Charlie's Hardware that I spoke to seemed to feel that because this company had some experience in the paper industry, there might be hope that the mills would stay open. Do you think that there's any hope at all for the mills and the people who live there?
I would take Wausau Paper at their word. One of the interesting things that's emerged is Wausau Paper, just the owner, has been locked in a 2-year hostel corporate battle with a hedge fund in Manhattan. In the process of them coming down really hard on Wausau Paper to break it up, and they have succeeded, by the way, a lot of information came out about how Wausau Paper has managed these mills. And this gets back to the point that Jerry was making and that, Glenn, you were making a little while ago. Wausau Paper was investing tens of millions of dollars into these mills to try everything they could to keep them open. This is the kind of transparency that came out with the hedge fund, and the hedge fund was caustic in its criticism. How can you be sinking, you know, $30 million into a mill that we're about to force you to close because it's uneconomical? I think that Wausau Paper has shown a track record of making an effort to find investment strategies to keep its mills open, and I think that they probably should get the benefit of the doubt that this other private equity firm that deals with distressed industries will at least make a good, honest faith run at it.
Jerry?
Yeah, and this is, again, where highly educated engineers make a difference here. People that can think on their feet, people that can see where cost reductions can be made, where efficiencies can be had. And sometimes that does take capital dollars to do. But the mills are being squeezed on the capital expenditures every year. And the decisions are tough ones to make. But the ones that they do make typically are pretty good. They've got very good return on investment when those decisions are made.
Now, Jerry, how do you feel about the macroeconomics involved here? These hedge funds run by people who have no connection to the communities that can be devastated by their decisions, forcing local companies to make these decisions regardless of whether they're in the best interest of the people who work in the mills and the businesses that have grown up around them. It seems to people who aren't living and breathing on Wall Street that there's got to be a better way to run the U.S. economy than this.
The human factor is the hardest one to accept when we talk about these economic strains in the industry that has such a history and such a rich tradition as it does in Wisconsin. That when you see, as your story indicated in the local town a few miles down the road here, that it does impact people. And to give the control to someone sitting in a New York high rise, making those decisions, it's tough to deal with. There is no quick answer other than, again, I come back to us thinking smarter, working harder, and putting the brain power and the innovation into play here. The other piece that hasn't been mentioned too often this afternoon is the whole area of sustainability and sustainable resources, renewable resources. John made the comparison again with China basically not having forest areas and having to transport the raw materials across the ocean one way and then ship it back across the ocean the other way? And can't a different model be engineered where we do take advantage of the fact that Wisconsin has such an, and the Midwest and many parts of this country have such a valuable and renewable resource that continues to replenish itself, unlike petroleum or some other things that are exhaustible. You know, where is the thought process from supporting and looking at what are the aces that this country holds in its hand? What are the natural resources that are renewable resources that can generate year after year, decade after decade, generation after generation, to produce products that mankind needs? And how do we make that happen? How do we get the attention of the people that can make decisions to support industries such as some of the other countries around the world have done?
Hey, can I just jump in on what Jerry just said, Glenn?
You bet.
So Jerry mentions again being smarter, innovating. There was a joke for a long time that went around the Wisconsin mills with every recession, the paper mills and the printing plants snapped back and often then grew some more and hired some more. And what happened was, you know, after the introduction of the personal computer, then the laptop, then the first generation or two of internet devices and mobile phones, demand for paper continued to grow. We had a really nicely produced graphic in our story, and if you want to go see it, it's all at www.jsonline.com/papercuts. I'd invite you to go see it. But the feeling was, hey, you know, we're living with anxiety of a coming paperless society, but we don't see it. This paperless society is actually pretty good for business. They don't make that joke anymore, of course, but it did underline a kind of complacency. And that's another thing that I heard over and over again in Wisconsin, that as other economies were developing a super tree, or as Wisconsin seemed to be able to bounce back from every recession, the emphasis on creative new thinking, many people think, went by the wayside. Many people think that R&D investments were in Wisconsin clearly declined. On the other hand, what you have in China, the biggest and most stunning innovation that they had is recycling. So they don't. It's hard to get pulp. It's hard to get trees. It's hard to get timber in China. We know that. What they did was absolutely brilliant. They created the world's biggest and most efficient recycling scheme. When you are recycling in your office bin, there's an excellent chance that that recycled paper is going not to the local mill where it used to go, but increasingly on freight rail over to the port of Seattle and then shipped straight to China where it gets de-inked and repulped. The Chinese, two-thirds of their total paper and paperboard output is recycled or reused.
And John, you
write
that scrap paper right now is the biggest export from the United States of America?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a shocking statistic.
As an American, it gives me no joy to say this, but we triple, quadruple proofed this. If you, the biggest U.S. export to China, as measured by container volume, is scrap paper by far, and these tables are also in our report that you'll find on the web quite easily.
And we're even sending some of our timber to China.
Oh, yeah. It comes from Wisconsin. The last numbers I saw was over $2 million of pulp and over $2 million separately of recycled paper. That's from a landlocked Midwestern state. If you go to the East Coast or the West Coast, the numbers are way higher. But the volume of scrap paper that the United States sends to China is so big, and this is a function of the way trade works, those huge, we've all seen pictures of these huge container ships coming from China to the United States. They're massive. They are loaded very often with things like touch screens and iPads, but they go back empty because the United States consumes.
We consume and we don't make anything.
More than we make. It's a dangerous imbalance. It's why there is a budget deficit. It's why there is a merchandise trade deficit. It's why there is a Tea Party and a debate about fiscal imbalances in this country. This is the root cause of it. It's a society. A household can't consume more than it produces on a sustainable basis, and neither can the country. So the ships, the freighters that go back empty allow the Chinese to negotiate dirt poor shipping rates, backhaul rates.
So they can load. They can load those.
And as a result, and this is the gut punch. There's so much recycled paper being shipped from the United States to China that the biggest U.S. export to the world, not just to China, but to the world by container volume, is scrap paper.
Yeah,
it's not exactly what you think about in terms of
John, just a second.
Proposition.
John, let Jerry jump in here.
Yeah, and there lies just one opportunity, okay? But somebody's got to get their head around it and figure out, okay, if you just look at it as, don't call it recycled paper, call it fiber, okay, and say, what do we do with fiber? Okay, we're very good at turning fiber into paper, okay? So the opportunity is there, but you need some leadership. You need some government directive to help assess that and say, here's what we can do with that valuable commodity. Here's what our American manufacturers could do with that commodity. It's there. And it's cheap, so let's use it. One example, again, I go back a few years, but John, you talked about the age of our machines in the U.S., the paper machines I'm talking now, and that's true that they are aged, and we haven't built many new ones in Wisconsin in quite a few years. One of the first awarenesses I had on a trip to Europe about 25 years ago was walked into a tour of a German paper mill. And they were tearing out a machine that was 10 years old. And I asked the production manager, I said, what are you doing? He says, well, we have incentives, okay, for improving productivity from the local government that would allow us to replace this machine with a new, wider, faster, more modern machine, a.k.a. like the one they built in China. So those kind of things can help and can help the paper industry.
I want to look at one guy who was an entrepreneur and a visionary who helped save a mill up in Park Falls. The Flambeau River Paper Mill used to be the old Smart Paper Mill. Several years ago, it almost closed. And a logger, Butch Johnson, bought it and got it running again. This is a piece that I actually produced about 6 years ago, 1 year after he did that. But it gives you an idea of the hope and the promise in what Butch Johnson did in Park Falls. 1 year ago this week, Governor Jim Doyle stood in front of a raucous crowd at the old Smart Paper plant in Park Falls and celebrated its return from bankruptcy.
Well, in the immortal words of Jackie Gleason, how sweet it is.
Doyle that day announced a $4 million state loan to reopen the shuttered plant under local ownership. Butch Johnson, the lumberjack who became the CEO for the new Flambeau River Papers, says a year later it was money well spent.
We put out over $20 million worth of wages and benefits. We take very good care of our employees. Good high-paying jobs. I think our average wage is about $20 an hour.
Flambeau River not only put about 300 local people back to work, Johnson says the company did it by being a leader in green technology and using renewable paper pulp to fuel its operation.
That boiler, when we started out, it was burning 50 tons of coal a day, and we reduced that now to 10 tons of coal. We'll have that into 0 tons of coal. We're going to make every effort we can of becoming totally fossil fuel free.
Johnson says Flambeau River has not yet realized its dream of turning paper pulp into ethanol and selling it on the open market. But the Park Falls entrepreneur says if the company builds on this past year's success, those things will happen in time. I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Now, that piece was produced 6 years ago, but John Schmidt, you mentioned in the article Paper Cuts that the biofuels experiment was brought to a halt in August.
That's correct. And in light of this conversation that we're having about innovation, Butch Johnson was the guy who made the effort. Butch Johnson, I can't count on how many times people called him a visionary. He was going to take the Wisconsin model and not just reinvigorate it, but take it further and make it greener than it ever was before. Cellulosic biodiesel, it's a great idea. And on paper, some scientists think it works. I'm sorry that, I guess had it worked, it would have been a home run for Wisconsin. It would have been a whole new turn in the whole biofuels, alternative fuels debate. he couldn't get it past the startup stage.
But even so, that mill is still up and running. It's still providing good-paying jobs for the people who live in the community. It's still providing revenue for the tax coffers. It's keeping the streets paved. It's keeping the restaurants and the banks and the gas stations open. You know, that's a success story, and there have been very few success stories in Wisconsin.
Oh, no doubt about it. And we took pains to depict that, what's going on, and the drama at that mill from all sides. Butch Johnson did take a number of subsidies himself, not unlike the Chinese, but not at their level, not the staggering level that the Chinese did. He's had to renegotiate the payment schedule on that. But from what I understand, he's operating in his niche. He's got good marketers. You're still going into bookstores and buying books that are printed on Park Falls paper made from Wisconsin-grown trees. And last time I talked to him, he said he was still eking out a thin little operating margin of profit.
Well, that's the whole thing. You bring in more money than you spend. Jerry?
Yeah, Glenn, you mentioned that was about 5 years back. And the biofuels is still in the laboratory stages in many cases. On campus at Point, there is some biofuels work going on in conjunction with the engineering department and the chemistry department. And so that story is yet to be told in terms of getting it up to a production level. More work needs to be done. More investment needs to be made from the educational standpoint. And a lot of work is continuing there.
But, you know, Thomas Edison didn't make a light bulb the first time he walked into the laboratory.
Right, right. But the future of biofuels from cellulose is going to happen, okay? And it's too big of an impact. We have too many trees on the planet to not look at them as a source of energy. One other aspect I would like to talk about is tissue. And the Wisconsin tissue industry is weathering this pretty well. And we talk about here in the Central Valley about printing papers, but there's another commodity made in Wisconsin, and they're tissue products. And
that's going to have to be a different show,
okay.
Because we're out of time, gentlemen. This hour has gone by very quickly. John Schmidt, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And Jerry Lazarski. Jerry, of course, is the executive director of the UW Stevens Point Paper Foundation and former vice president with Stora Enso America. John Schmidt, investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can find a link to his series on the paper industry, Paper Cuts, on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. And thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.